Millennium Knife. It's nice to be back. I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film critic for TheWrap.com and What the Flick, and was not here last week. Thank you to Bibbs of the B-Movies podcast and Crave Online for sitting in. And this week, you got no Dave White. He is out of town, and hopefully he is sitting somewhere and memorizing the email address to this podcast, which he apparently forgot last week because I wasn't here to tell it for him. So, yeah, we'll talk about that next week when he's back. Anyway, so very excited. We've had a chain of illustrious guest co-hosts on this show, but perhaps no one with the showbiz bona fides of today's guest. He is the founder of Film Threat, which was the game-changing movie zine back when there were zines, back before there was an internet. You've seen him on TV. You've heard him Remora-like attaching himself to other podcasts because that's his new gig on his new show, Pod Crash. Please welcome Chris Gore.
Wow, Alonzo, first of all, when you were starting with this whole big hype about this person that was going to be on the show, I thought, where are they? I want to meet that guy. He sounds so accomplished. I certainly don't feel that way.
Don't be so modest. Look, you're Chris Gore, man. You know that.
That's the thing is, like, when people ask, it's like, what's your job? I always like to say writer, because that's, I mean, that's how I've always described myself. But then it's like I sort of got dragged into doing TV and any sort of gig. Then I got dragged into doing podcasts. It seems like every gig that I sort of end up jumping into, I've never really done that thing before, and I like to. I recently been called a Renaissance nerd, and I'll just go with that because
nice.
I'm multi-talented, but that also just makes me difficult to classify.
Well, yeah, I'm not hearing me on this. Is this? Are you hearing you in the headphones?
I hear myself pretty good. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what's going on.
I hear you pretty well.
Okay. All right. Maybe that's better.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said that you and Chris Hardwick are the guys who really pioneered the idea of monetizing nerd.
Yeah.
You know.
He's done a pretty good job. I will say Hardwick's done a great job. I don't know that I've monetized it as I've just sort of, I can't be anything else. So whenever anyone else is trying to put me in a box of you're going to be this, I don't do well at that. I really do well at, like, nerd is where my core is. And I think that, like, where, you know, when I had the opportunity to be on G4 and just talk movies and be used in other ways on that network, on Attack of the Show, it was great. It was like, oh, well, these are my people. That's where I really felt like I began to build an audience. Because even amongst the indie film crowd, they can be a little snobby sometimes. Mm. It can be a little snooty.
Right.
And I was the guy that, like, I would go to Sundance and then I'd go to Comic-Con. And then after a while, I'd start to see these guys in San Diego from Sundance. I'm like, what are you guys doing here? They say, well, what are you doing here? It's like, I've been coming here for 20 years.
On my own dime.
Yeah, because I've been coming here since the early 90s. Like, where have you been? Like, when it was like an actual comic book convention at a college, you know?
Right,
why are you here? Like, so whatever. I mean, that stuff kind of crosses over. But if you can figure out how I can make money at it, let me know, because that would be awesome.
Well, one thing I've figured out as an adult is, you know, there's that thing they always tell people, like, who are aspiring actors or one of those gigs that doesn't pay well and it's super hard to get into. They always say, if you have a backup, do that.
Right.
You know, you really can only do this if there is nothing else on earth that you are, like, qualified to do or that you could get yourself out of bed to do every day without shooting yourself in the face.
I love those kind of platitudes. Like, John Waters had the best one. He said, try and do something for 10 years, and if you achieve no success in 10 years, you should stop. So I think that's really sound advice. Like, look, if you've been struggling for a certain period of time to be successful in a certain medium, whatever, you know, artistic thing you choose, and you're not having any luck at it, it's probably a good idea to consider other options. But, for myself, I feel like what I've always tried to do is kind of fit my interests with a way to make money with my interests.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where Film Threat began. And then everything else is like, I'd like to see a cartoon show that did this thing, that had this kind of story and was different than the kind of other BS that you see. So everything that I've created is like, I just want to see it. If I end up making money at it, great. If I don't, I'm not going to kill myself with stress. So,
now tell us a little about Pod Crash, because I thought when I first heard about it, I just thought it was. Oh, sorry, I'm trying to be all smooth here, but there's no. I cannot multitask.
First of all, but wait a second. I love this because, like, all the things, like, putting the cassette in for the music at the beginning, I love, because I like anything, and this comes from, I guess, indie, because everything kind of is just being real. I think being real, I think that also translates to comedy. I think it translates also to, there's too much, you know, just having been involved in big productions and then like smaller DIY stuff. And it doesn't matter, you know, just like I prefer stuff that's not overproduced, stuff that's real, that you acknowledge stuff to the audience, whether it be in stand-up comedy or like
in our case, it's sheer incompetence because we couldn't figure out how to like drag a digital file in and not have it be way too loud compared to the rest of the show. And so, yeah, Dave actually came up with the ka-chunk, ka-chunk cassette thing, and that's become our thing now.
But it's
so,
character, and it's real, and I love that. Those are things that I'm attracted to. I think that it's, I mean, Soderbergh, I think, is that kind of filmmaker. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at his stuff, even in the stuff that's like Contagion, even the stuff that ends up being bigger, he adds a reality to it, and I'm a big fan of the way he's able to do the big films and the small films like Bubble, and they have a reality that people connect with.
Well, we were talking before about, you know, how analog is disappearing and how people don't have the shelf of CDs anymore, the shelf of DVDs. They've all got these digital files and, you know, one solar flare and we lose everything.
Precisely. I mean, I was looking around here and I'm thinking like, wow, you guys, you have all these amazing books, like amazing pop culture stuff. And I'm thinking like, wow, this would fit on one iPad. That's it. One iPad and all this stuff goes away. And there is sort of like, I may have noticed with myself, kind of a purge where it's like, and it's just also from moving recently a couple times. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I just,
but
I don't
want. That's when you really decide what means anything to you.
Right. I don't want to carry it anymore. I don't want to put it up. My thing is if it has to be in storage or a closet, I don't want it. Mm-hmm. If I have room to display it and it doesn't look cluttered or whatever, it's like, I'm into that. I want to just have just enough. And then I'll just get, if it digitally exists, then I'm good. So, yeah, but you're right about the solar flares thing. I was at this 2012 conference. We talked about that, where this guy's theory was, is that what will happen in 2012 isn't some giant cataclysm, isn't some nuclear disaster, isn't the end of the world. What it'll be is a giant solar flare that will knock out the entire power grid and all electronic devices in the United States. Mm. And we could prevent this by effectively spending like $10 billion putting in what our basically power strips into our power grid to prevent this from occurring.
Surge protectors,
exactly. This would prevent this from happening. And what this guy's theory is that what it'll do is create this new spiritual reawakening where all these devices that we have now, our mobile devices, computers, iPads, we're always looking at screens. The character said this in a movie I just saw with Paul Rudd. Why am I spacing? My Idiot Brother.
Yeah.
Yes, that line was in there. We're always looking at screens, like, all of that will go away and effectively removing the walls and barriers we have to real human personal connection, which is, you know, eye contact.
Right.
I've done it. I've actually done eye contact. But like all of that will then create this thing, this sort of, while it'll be chaos in the United States for the next decade, replacing and recreating this grid, this power grid, getting us back to what we used to have, it'll actually make us connected. And there'll be, you know, Facebook, all that stuff won't exist. Everything will be dead and gone. You ever had like the power go out like for a day and you have candles, you actually pick up a book and go, you know what? There's something about, I feel liberated.
It is kind of a cool, and like I know there are people who do that thing where they disconnect one day a week and they don't check their email and they turn off their cell phone and they completely sort of disengage from the grid. I can't do it. I'm sure I should, and it would be awesome, but I'm the teat is too much for me.
Yeah,
I can't,
yeah. You know. Well, it's me too. And I've got like, look, I've got an iPad, I got an iPhone, I have my MacBook Pro, all that stuff in it. I feel like I wish my MacBook Pro didn't have Wi-Fi. Because sometimes it's so distracting when you're trying to focus and work. And then I thought that was an interesting theory from the 2012 guy. Sure. I posited the other thing. I said, well, my theory is that the Mayans foresaw the movie 2012. And then when they saw the trailer for it and saw the disaster with John Cusack, you know, driving around in that limousine and California falls into the earth. Like, if you saw that in a primitive mind, would think that that's...
You'd think it was a dream or an omen or something.
Yeah, you would think that that's a real disaster. But what you're really seeing is a movie trailer.
You know, do you watch Doomsday Preppers by chance?
No, what's that?
That's a Dave White favorite. It's on like National Geographic. I forget, like some cable channel that should be doing something classier than Doomsday Preppers. But it's a reality show by people who are convinced that the end times are coming, whether it's the solar flares or a nuke or like the international monetary crisis. Like everybody has their own different scenario, and then it's a question of like how are they preparing. And so you've got this guy in New York City who his entire apartment is sort of like disaster proofed, and he's got the giant like body bag size things for to store water in, you know. Or you have these people that live out in the middle of nowhere, and they are completely self, like they garden, they grow all their own food, they're completely independent. You know, this guy who's like buying a big metal shipping container and burying it in his backyard to be his bunker, you know. So you see all the stuff that people have and how they're preparing, and then some panel of unseen experts rates everybody on how their prepping is going. It's crazy because, like, you know, you had this one where they had, you know, the canned goods and the vegetables and the water and the shotguns and blah, 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 but they both weighed 400 pounds.
But what's funny is that, you know, my whole thought in hearing you say this is, what's fashion going to be like? Because if it's like Mad Max or most other post-apocalyptic movies, everyone dresses in leather and bondage wear like they're going to a fetish club. And I'm thinking, I don't look that great in that stuff, to be honest. Like, if I'm shirtless with leather and chains, you know, with a collar on, I don't look that great. So I'm thinking, fashion-wise, because you're not going to have access to, you know, washing machines, right? We're not going to be walking around in T-shirts. We're going to be wearing leather and rubber. Or at least that's what the movies have taught me.
Yeah, the movies definitely, I think there's a supply of eyeliner that survives the apocalypse, yes. Apparently. So everybody can be all, you know.
Well, I'll be goth and fetish, but like, yeah, I don't look so great in that stuff. So this is my concern. Fashion in the post-apocalypse. How will I survive?
Well, luckily, I think that olive drab is very flattering to most skin tones.
Right.
So, you know, unless you're like a redhead or something and you need something a little greener, you know, probably, you know, something in the camo family, you'll be all right.
I'm so light skinned. I will not do well.
Yeah, I was gonna say you better have the closet of SPF 40 or something for the end times.
Yeah.
All right. So one big movie this week and a couple of minor ones, and we both saw Snow White and the Huntsman,
which was the worst sequel to Thor I've ever seen. Thor 2 blows. Hey, do you want to start? I don't know where to start.
No, I think you should dive in on this one.
I will dive in. Someone tweeted recently, I forget who it was, that Kristen Stewart is this generation's Keanu Reeves.
Ooh.
I kind of think that's true. She definitely has that sort of vapidness where you can ascribe any personality traits that you might think appropriate to her because she is a blank slate. I like her. I think her. To me, her acting style is sort of mouth agape, because it's just real. Literally, watch Kristen Stewart. Her mouth is never closed. Almost never closed. It's always sort of, you know, half open, and she has those teeth. So I just find her dull. Chris Hemsworth, I mean, I think he did the sort of best he could, but he seems so familiar in this role. I thought, well, it's kind of like Thor covered in mud.
Yeah,
if Thor was cast out. Yeah, drunk Thor covered in mud. And he really was. It was kind of the same performance without all the arrogance.
Mm.
A little bit of the arrogance. But I just felt that the person who really ruined the movie was
Charlize Theron.
Charlize Theron. Why did I say Gwyneth Paltrow? They're all going for these roles.
Because she's a ruiner, but not
right. But Charlize Theron really was disappointing in it. I mean, it wasn't over the top enough to be entertaining. And this film completely lacked. I've never heard of this director.
It wasn't over the top enough.
Right. What I mean is that in order for it to project to the audience that it was comedic, because it wasn't funny, and that's what the film lacked to
that's
me.
That's true.
There was no sense of humor. It was deadpan.
It took itself
too seriously.
It was camp in the traditional sense of the word, in that you can't do it on purpose.
Right.
You know, so yeah, she's not giving like her big crazy performance is an attempt at giving a real performance, which she isn't doing.
Yes!
She's being Faye Dunaway, basically. And
Dave
liked it more than I did, and he was equating it with sort of like Faye Dunaway, Mommy Dearest, and Elizabeth Berkley, Showgirls, that sort of like no filter, going for the back wall. But to me, it just felt big and unwieldy and kind of hammy.
It looks like it's also one of those things where if it was subtitled, people would have liked it better. You know, like, I love this foreign film. That's why I think that certain movies translate better in other markets, because you know, we recognize being in, you know, the native American English with those accents. It just came off so dry. It was just And also the thing that also bothered me is how dirty everything was. Everything was mud and black, and the digital effects so stood out as digital to me. The dwarves were the only highlight in the film, like with these weird cameos. Bob Hoskins,
yeah,
Nick Frost.
But
like,
I couldn't stop looking at the dwarves and thinking, how do they do that? Because you've got Nick Frost and Toby Jones and Ian McShane and Ray Winstone and Eddie Marsan. And the whole time I was thinking, is it their faces grafted onto an actual little person?
That's right. Deal? It's kind of like how they did the effects with Chris Evans in Captain America, and they made him skinny.
Okay.
He had a skinny guy. I mean, he basically, Chris Evans acted those scenes. They just only used the part with his face.
Right. So it's like the guy in The Social Network whose face you'll never see because they put
Armie Hammer
on it.
Yeah, the other actor. Yeah. I think that it's, you know, they become so good at that. That was the only digital effect that actually was pulled off well.
It was done well, but I found it so distracting because I knew that all those actors were not actual, you know, little people. Because Mirror Mirror, which came out a few months ago, which was not very good, but they cast 7 really charming and engaging little people actors who I had never seen before.
Now, I wonder what little people think of this, of like taller people taking their jobs.
I'm sure. It's like, you know, look, if I can't get cast in a Snow White movie, like, where's the union, you know?
Right. But I really, really dislike this film. It was just one of those that lacked heart, didn't care about anybody. Just everything that was wrong with it stood out and was distracting. It felt, and I don't know who the director was, but
first time guy. He did that Halo short film that people love.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was that guy?
Yeah, Rupert something.
I don't know. Well, I feel like a lot of these guys, just because they can pull off something that is, you know, that looks, just because they can pull off spectacle doesn't mean they can pull off real human emotion. I think that you need the marriage of the two really to make.
I think because now with CG, it's all like, well, we can make this look awesome. And oh, look, this is a dress made of ravens or whatever.
But there's
no script. Like they give, there's like 2 dudes in this movie. It's like, because it's the law that Kristen Stewart has to be in a love triangle, but they don't make either of them very interesting. You don't get a full sense of how they feel about her, how she feels about them. The ending even kind of leaves it sort of like, yeah, like they're there, they're present, but like no, there's no feeling at all.
Right. I mean, I guess we should have guessed because it said from the producers of Alice and Wonderland.
Yes.
which was also a disappointment. But I really was hoping this would have been the one, because I remember seeing the trailers for Mirror Mirror, which I have not seen, and it just looked so dumb. I thought, are they going for Princess Bride, but the lowbrow version of Princess Bride, like without any of the cleverness?
They were attempting to be very arch, and Julia Roberts does not have that brand of humor in her. There's some kind of comedies that she does well, but she does not do the big drag queen kind of thing very well. The only people in that movie that got the joke right were Nathan Lane and the dwarves, and that was it. Like everybody else, like Armie Hammer, bless him, you know, handsome man and a good actor in other films, but so not getting the comedy right on that one.
He did follow the one big piece of advice I give to all actors, because I just doing a lot of panels and stuff, I get a lot of people asking, hey, what should I do? My best advice to actors, just be good looking.
Well done, then, Armie Hammer.
Yeah, yeah. But so your thoughts?
Yeah, I was unengaged. I mean, there were individual moments that looked really good. You know, little like the thing with the dress and the you know. And I liked where they were going with the queen, as far as like, you know, where she's eating the hearts of birds with her little metal claw fingernail thing. You know, it's like, okay, there are some ideas here, but it was so lacklusterly written, you know. And you've got this American actress, an Australian actor, and a South African actress all doing that sort of generic fancy British accent that everybody does in movies when it's supposed to be period or, you know.
Well, that's the thing. It's funny because it's fantasy, right? Yeah. So it's fantasy. Who gives a shit? Who gives a shit? It's fantasy. What difference does it make? I guess it's associated.
Clean podcast.
Oh, sorry about that.
It's okay. I'll do
okay.
It.
You'll bleep it.
I'll bleep it.
Bleep it. It'll be funny.
Yes.
It is sort of a generic thing, because even in Game of Thrones they do that, but it's not clearly identified. Look, in Game of Thrones they do it. Where are they? Are they on Earth?
Who knows?
Who knows where they are? Okay. In Snow White and the Huntsman, where are they? What country?
True. Yeah. It's that sort of, you know, fable-y land.
Is it merry old England? Because it's not. It really is. I guess you're right. They just use that accent because that's what we associate with fairy tales. It's just sort of the thing of, you know what? Ever since I, Claudius, or actually a lot of other Roman, big Roman epics, you know what? Italians, They speak in British accents.
Yes, that's the true. Italians are Ben-Hur, yeah. Quo Vadis. Yeah.
Or if you're a commander in the Star Wars universe, which was a long time ago, you also have a British accent.
This is true.
Or if you were raised in the domed cities in the film Logan's Run, and you're just the two leads, then you have British accents, Jenny Agutter and Michael York. It always stood out to me, like, why am I the only one that notices those two?
I never
British
thought
accents,
about that. Yeah.
And no one else.
Farrah Fawcett doesn't have one.
She doesn't have an, you know, Doc doesn't have one. All the other Sandmen, they just speak American.
But Peter Ustinov has one.
Peter Ustinov has one, but he survived in the White House? This makes no sense. It really is because the director was British. And so they cast British leads, but they, you know, they shot that at a mall in Dallas.
Oh, no, I
Logan's
know.
Run.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Merchandise Mart.
Yes. Right? One of my favorite, it's one of my favorite classic.
And the water gardens in Fort Worth, the ending stuff.
Oh, I love it. I love Logan's Run. But still, if you begin to question the accents, you really start, the whole thing starts to fall apart. It's stupid.
My favorite crazy use of the British accent as other is, you remember the movie Gorky Park?
Oh, long time ago.
Yeah,
yes.
With William Hurt, is based on a big bestseller at the time, this sort of murder mystery unfolding in the Kremlin, you know. Everybody's Russian, but they all have British accents, which is fine, except for the fact that they cast Joanna Pakula, who is a Polish actress, as the female lead, and she is speaking in an Eastern European accent. So everybody, like William Hurt, all the Soviets are speaking with the generic British accent that we've kind of come to know as foreign,
right?
You know, but she's doing the real thing, and it was extremely jarring.
But now Russians, who are, you know, they've been villains in movies now, we kind of know what the Russian accent is. I just think that comes with, like, now movies are much more international, and I feel like, because this is a much larger topic about where funding comes from.
True.
Funding is not from the studios now,
yeah,
because they're pretty much
Dubai and India.
That's why the Mission Impossible was, you know, shot in the Middle East, like parts of it. I mean, like, these movies need to be international because that's where the funding comes from, so that they need to be more international in flavor.
And they have to make more money overseas to turn a profit because they've gotten so ridiculously expensive.
So, and not to sound xenophobic, but I mean, the American identity as it is to so-called American films is dying on the table. It's going away because of where the funding comes from. The real, that American, that true American film is gone.
You know, in a sense,
am I wrong in this?
I'm not going to weep too much for that, because I think in a lot of ways we sort of operated in this bubble where it's sort of like, you know, us and the rest of the world. And in so many facets of the economy and, you know, political structure, I think that a lot of that stuff is shifting right now, you know?
Right.
We're not the economic superpower that we were from the end of World War II to, say, 1980, you know? And so, yeah, I think we are becoming a more international society, and part of that is being reflected in both how movies are made and how movies make their money back.
Well, it's also, and this is what I'm saying, is, like, I grew up watching foreign films. I grew up, like, reading subtitles, grew up with, you know, filmmakers like Woody Allen. Mm. But I feel the true American filmmakers, I liked a movie that this felt and like an American movie.
Well,
and these ones felt like this was a Russian science fiction. This is a British film. I like those kind of flavors, just the same way I like different foods.
But I don't think American movies are disappearing. Like, I think what you mean is that Hollywood movies are becoming less uniquely American.
Okay, that, yes, yes.
There will still be American voices and American stories told in films, and you know, more on the indie level probably, because they don't have to have the mega budgets that your Mission Impossible 4s do, you know. But yeah, I think that when the sort of the big schlocky special effects expensive stuff that has to make $1 billion worldwide, yeah, that's gonna start having more, you know, there's gonna be more colors in the paint box.
Well, it's,
know,
like two of my favorite characters, you know, Batman and Superman. I mean, the Dark Knight movies were directed and written by a Brit.
Right.
Batman acted by a Brit. Mm. Superman is executive produced also by Christopher Nolan, Brit. Directed by a Canadian, Zack Snyder, and starring Henry Cavill, who is British as well. So it's weird that it's like, here are these iconic American heroes, the myths that we created, our modern myths, right? Like, you know, the older myths are, you know, you've got your Hercules and whatnot, you've got those gods, you've got Jesus Christ, okay? And here's the myths that we created in America were superheroes. That is a wholly American thing. And now, American superheroes are being played by foreigners.
But you know what?
And I'm not saying, I'm not being xenophobic. I'm saying that maybe their understanding of it is better because they have one, they're a step removed from the myth.
Yeah.
They didn't grow up here. So maybe there's a way, and look, those characters do translate to other countries. I mean,
sure.
They're Batman and Superman fans all over the world. And so, and there's even like a Superman series called Red Sun where capsule landed in Russia.
Right, right, right.
Which is really fascinating. I love that kind of thinking. It's just, I find it funny that these myths are now being interpreted in other ways.
Well, I think that, you know, we've always had something of an inferiority complex when it comes to British actors and filmmakers, you know?
They
I think
just sound cooler.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we're perfectly ready to step aside and let them take over, especially because they tend to do better American accents than American actors do British accents, you know? But at the same time, I'm sure somebody in England is furious that Robert Downey Jr. is playing Sherlock Holmes. So,
right,
you know,
right.
It goes both ways. You know?
Yeah, yeah, you're right. And I'm not even saying it as it's a bad thing.
No,
I'm
no,
just
no. It's just a thing that's happening, yeah.
I'm just pointing it out as like, hey, you should notice that. That's kind of funny.
I agree. But
we'll see if the audience of the podcast agrees.
Check
the comments section or the letters, which you can send by email to
linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Write it down, Dave White. two other movies this week that you were lucky enough not to see. First of all, one that I know Dave is really wishes he were here to discuss, and we may go into it in more detail next week, even though it will probably be gone from theaters. A movie called Battlefield America.
Right.
From the makers of You Got Served, the poster proclaims proudly.
Kidding?
Yeah. And it's basically about like these 8-year-old dance crews that throw down in the back alleys of Long Beach, like long after they should all be in bed, and the fierce competition and how they're all building up to this big battle of the crews called Battlefield America that's never explained very well at all. And other than that, it's basically the Mighty Ducks, where you've got the like jerk exec guy who gets a DUI and he's got to do community service, and so he gets to go to the Long Beach like rec center and like help these kids believe in themselves and learn how to dance and blah blah blah. And it's terrible.
Well, I just got an email from Dave White. He says he loved it, so I don't know what you're thinking.
No, actually, his review is on movies.com. It's pretty hilarious. But I mean, it's like, you know, and in my review, I even say, okay, yes, fine. Assuming that you don't care about direction or plot or characters or the writing or anything else, and you're just there to see the dancing, no shot lasts longer than 3 seconds when they're dancing.
Oh,
it's edited like crazy. I mean, you have no idea if these kids can actually do anything because they sort of, like somebody will sort of vault in the air and then it'll be cut to some other angle and something else is happening. And, you know, in my review, I said that with filmmaking like this, you could turn 2 easy chairs and a bowl of cottage cheese into Cirque du Soleil. You know, it's like, it drives me crazy. And this is a general problem with musicals and dance movies of recent vintage. Is that you don't get a full, like, a 5, 6, 7, 8, like, you know, anybody going through a dance move. It's like, I don't know if it's Baz Luhrmann's fault or MTV's or whatever, but it's just like cut, 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 cut. And, you know, who knows if these people are dancing, you know?
That's such a valid criticism because when you look at, like, you know, older, look at West Side Story, one of my favorite music, I mean, play translated to the silver screen directed by Robert Wise.
Right.
One of the last films to have an overture.
Yeah.
Actually, the last film to have an overture, my understanding, was Gandhi.
Maybe so, yeah. The 60s, actually, after Sound of Music and like the big mega musicals, like all the studios were making them, a lot of those had, because it was those roadshow productions and they would have overtures. But yeah,
oddly,
that was
Star Trek the Motion Picture also had an overture.
Oh yeah, well,
if you get the
anything to make that movie longer. You know?
Yes, exactly. But it's because you don't get the sense that, like in West Side Story, you get the sense that, like, wow, they really are pulling out, like, because it's just a lot of long shots.
Yeah, and Jerome Robbins, who had choreographed the stage version, was he gets a co-director credit on the film and he did all the dance stuff, and you get to see the dancing.
Yeah,
like it's happening.
But first of all, and also I have to just give myself credit that I'm not even gay, and I segued from this dance movie, your dance movie review, to a reference to West Side Story. We got into some of the details of West Side Story. I have to give myself some gay credit.
Well done. You did manage to pull it out with Star Trek, though. Although both films were directed by Robert Wise.
Oh, that's a there's the connection. Look at this. Now, I do have to say also, because I remember when the weekend that Bucky Larson opened.
Oh, God.
I hit you up on Twitter, and I'm like, so how is it? And I forgot what you said, but it was really funny. It was just like it's worse than you could possibly imagine. Like, there wasn't a screening, right? Because you tweeted that you had to pay to see it.
Oh, yeah. I went to a midnight show, like, on that Thursday, because they did not show it to the press. It was that good.
Oh, my God. It's one of the worst things. I've since seen it. It's god awful. But we got into some conversation about how it's more fun to read a bad review than it is to write some sort of soaring praise of something. Like,
well, it's
bad
easier,
reviews are
yeah.
fun. It, certainly it's easier. Movies that sort of end up in the middle, which is most films, I would say Snow White and the Huntsman is sort of just in the middle.
Yeah.
Looked great, unspectacular, you won't remember it. And you'll see it on a plane in 6 months and you'll think, what was all the hype about? But something that's so spectacularly awful is so much fun to write a review of and discuss.
True. And I think Battlefield America definitely falls into that category because it's the kind of movie where, like, they just sort of throw things up and then don't ever address them again. Like,
right.
There's this rival dance crew and they've won Battlefield America 3 times, but they don't seem to have much to show for it. Like, they don't seem any more special than the other crews. It's not like they come rolling up in limos or something, you know, like, ooh, they won. And then they have this coach who sort of gets in the face of the Mighty Ducks guy, but never much and never particularly threateningly. Like, you can tell he's really trying to be all sweep the leg Johnny, but it's just not coming to him, you know? It's a super random film. And then, like, you know, decent actresses are in it, which is always depressing. Like, it's like when you go to a Tyler Perry movie, you know, like one that's really not very good, because there are some that are okay. But where you're thinking, like, wow, like, you know, Alfre Woodard really does not getting any better offers right now than to star in this movie, you know? And so, like, in this one, like, Lynn Whitfield and Valerie Pettiford turn up and you're like, okay, well, it's a check, you know?
I'm actually feel very confident and say I've never seen a Tyler Perry movie.
Wow.
I feel pretty good. I feel good about that.
You are clearly not like a working film critic.
I will die.
There's no escaping them.
I will die and I'll think, wow, didn't miss anything. All good.
You know, this is a conversation for when Madea's Witness Protection comes out, which is later this month, and I just saw the trailer and I can't wait. It's been interesting to watch his progression because he's actually kind of gotten competent as a director. He's still a terrible writer.
Right.
But, like, Good Deeds looks like a real movie. Like, it was shot, like, it looks like someone knew what they were doing, and it's edited together well, and it, you know, it's visually kind of interesting and stylish, and it looks like a movie, whereas the first ones are so, like, you can tell he has no idea what he's doing. Now if he would just stop writing them, you know, and, like, then I think we might be onto something. But I have to say, Madea's Witness Protection looks pretty hilarious, and Denise Richards is in it, so.
I don't know, the thing is I love stuff with drag queens. Like, Divine is my hero, Glenn Milstead, the actor who played Divine in all the John Waters films, and also turned up a few places here and there, never quite crossed over mainstream, unfortunately.
Was on the verge of doing so when he died. Sadly.
Right.
I think when Hairspray was really going to be his entree into, you know, more mainstream stuff. Did you ever see Trouble in Mind?
No.
Alan Rudolph movie. He is out of drag and he plays this very intimidating mobster.
Wow.
It's worth checking out.
Wow. All right. Wow. You learn something new on every podcast.
But anyway, yeah. So, yeah, Tyler Perry is not. I mean, he's not even really trying to be a drag queen. I mean, Madea just throws on a house coat and a fat suit and is just, like, sassy. And, you know, apparently when you see the stage productions, he's not even wearing makeup. He just puts the wig and the glasses on and the house dress and, you know, he goes
That's
to
it.
Town. Yeah, so it's not a really elaborate creation per se, but Madea can be pretty hilarious, and that's probably the best. That's the best thing he's got going for him. So,
does the audience know that if you tried to have sex with Madea, Madea is a tranny?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not a mystery to anybody.
No, but what I'm saying is, why don't they just play that up? Why don't they try to target the tranny loving audience?
Well, the character is a woman. I don't know.
Well, are we sure the character is a woman? The character
Oh,
there should be a reveal where it's like, look, Madea. I never said Madea was a woman. You just assumed.
I'm trying
Madea
to,
has a penis.
I'm trying to remember if Madea has children or if she's just everybody's aunt.
Yeah, everybody's crazy aunt.
I'll have to go back and check the check the canon on that one.
There isn't any. I really feel like you should. It'd be great. I'd love to interview Tyler Perry and ask him. I think it's just really brave that you've made the public embrace a transsexual in all your films. I love that. It's never specifically said, right? You would know better than I because I've never seen these.
I'd have to go back and look. I want to say that she's got kids, but I could be wrong. I'll have to wiki this one and find out. If any listeners, if you are more down on the whole Madea family tree, you know, if you watch Meet the Browns on TBS or whatever, and you have insight into this, please share it with us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. So yeah, anyway, Battlefield America, big snooze, and not nearly as fun as. Have you ever seen Standing Ovation?
Oh no, is this another dance one?
Oh, it's a dance movie. Yeah, it's one of those movies where like kids seem to exist in this sort of adult free world. Uh-huh. And it's like the most blatant manifestation of that whole kind of post American Idol I deserve to be famous right now mentality that I think we're raising an entire generation to have,
right?
And it's bonkers, this movie. Phil Blankenship, who has used to program at New Beverly, I think he's doing some stuff at CineFamily now, has done a couple of midnight screenings of it, and that's how I went and saw it. And it's on Netflix Instant. You should really check it out. It's terrible. I mean, they sing a bunch of really bad songs, but like it's just you look at it and you think, who thought this was a good idea, and who thought that this worldview makes any sense at all? You know, so if you're going to see a movie about dancing children, check out Standing Ovation.
I will put that on the list that I'll get to the queue.
Watch it on a plane if they've got internet. You know.
But every time I see those dance crew movies, I just check out. It's like those are just like a movie I can just check and go, not going. Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's you operate in a world where you get to decide what you see and what you don't see.
Yeah, yeah, well.
That's adorable.
No, well, thanks. Yeah, but no, I do feel lucky that it's like, hey, here's the DVDs that I reviewed this week. And then I go see the movies I really want to. I really feel like time is just limited with like other projects I'm working on.
I hear you.
In addition,
too much media out there.
Right, there's too much. It's like there are too many things that I have to do that involve sitting down. I need things. Can I stand and watch the film? That's why I have a weird habit of like when I go to bars, I like to stand, like at the bar, not actually sit on the stool. I'm happy to give my stool up to whoever would like to sit because I do too much sitting down, and I know that that's supposed to not be good for you health wise.
Right. Yeah, no, Dave actually will set up his computer there on the kitchen counter and will stand there for a couple hours because he gets uncomfortable.
Oh, really? Let's see. You know, it's smart. When you've heard of those standing desks that they have now.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was a whole subplot in The Office where, you know, Rainn Wilson's character, Dwight Schrute. Why did I say McShrute?
I don't know.
McFly? I don't know. But Dwight Schrute is like, he gets the standing desk and then he can't really last a day standing all day.
I didn't see that.
Yeah.
The movie that I kind of was hoping you were going to see, because I really wanted to hear, well, just the general straight guy perspective, and in particular, your straight guy perspective.
Wait, just because I haven't seen it doesn't mean I won't have an opinion about it.
Fair enough. Piranha 3DD.
Okay, that's one where I would love to see that movie. I'm probably going to see that movie at the drive-in. There is one last drive-in.
But there's a few.
There's a few. There's about 200 in the United States.
There's a few in Southern California, even.
Yes, a couple in San Diego. There's one in Oakland.
There's one in the City of Industry.
That's the one I go to.
Okay, well, have you not been to the Mission Tiki in Montclair?
No. The Mission Tiki.
The Mission Tiki is amazing.
Is it?
Out there for my birthday.
Does it have four screens?
Yes.
I love that.
It has four screens. It has freshly poured asphalt, unlike the one in the City of Industry.
City of Industry is a I still go.
Again with the
You gotta bleep that.
I will. The trains do run through it like they do at City of Industry, but it's really good projection, an amazing concession stand.
The concessions at the other place are
They're awful. Terrifying. No. But at the Mission Tiki, you can get carne asada fries and funnel cakes. It's amazing.
I'm actually putting it. I've got to look it up right now.
Yeah, you have to go to Mission Tiki. I can't believe you don't know about this.
I can't believe I don't know about it because I thought I knew about every drive-in.
But the thing is, you can't see. They don't do 3D movies at the drive-in.
No, right. Yeah, exactly. Which I don't care about. Like, I like to see bad movies at the drive-in because what's cool about it is I've seen all the Fast and Furious movies, but at the drive-in.
Oh, yeah. Fast Five at the drive-in was amazing.
Yeah, okay. I'm not saying it's a good movie. I actually hated that film.
But at the drive-in.
At the drive-in, it's cool because you're behind the driver's seat, like, watching a movie. In a car about car,
and you can
it's
be
great.
All
the yes. Mission Tiki in Montclair.
Mission Tiki in Montclair, and in August they're doing this amazing series that like TCM is sponsoring on Sunday nights. They're showing Lolita, Bonnie and Clyde, Viva Las Vegas, and To Catch a Thief, and it's $1 a car load.
Oh, you can't. I mean, because the thing is about the one in City of Industry, the Pacific Vineland Drive-In Theater. Google that.
I've
Pacific Vineland. It's It's well, they show first run movies,
right?
They and it's
so
it's,
does the Mission Tiki. This is a special thing, though.
Yeah. But it's amazing that they've got these first run films, and yes, the 3D movies are never in 3D, which right. is fine. But like, the concessions are bad. I usually just bring a cooler of beer. I get a pizza on the way. I bring my sports chairs. I crank it up. What's great is that the kids leave like around, you know, after the first movie.
Right.
So all the carloads with families of kids either leave or the kids are tucked into the back seat. Just fall asleep
in their PJs.
Yeah, but like it's wafting quite. It smells very. it smells like a
incense,
weird incense.
Perhaps?
A weird incense I've never smelled. Now the whole place.
Well, you should totally check out the Mission Tiki. It's like, I mean, you drive up and the ticket booths are little thatched huts with torches.
Oh,
like
wow.
It is themed. They really kick out the jam.
Oh god,
it's a great
I'm
place
going.
To go to movies.
I'm going.
How did we get here? Piranha 3DD.
Oh, right. I did not see it and. I'm sure it's as bad as the first one. I liked the first one from the standpoint of didn't care about any of the characters. It didn't matter except for the kids. I don't want kids to get. But like it was brutal. I mean, the effects were cheesy. I liked the first movie just because it knew what it was. It was so stupid. And all the people were jerks got what they deserved.
I loved the first one.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
The first one
okay,
was
good.
Bananas. It was so... Like
it knew what it was.
It knew what it was,
right.
And it took it to the nth degree. And
yes.
It got so like I mean, the gore was so over the top that it was funny. It was like early Peter Jackson kind of gore,
right? And
you
we
know?
Could say penis on this podcast because
yes.
It's a medical term. I mean, penis was in. It's just like, but it's like, right? The guy that everyone, this guy, you know, who does the Girls Gone Wild, the real guy, what's his name?
Joe Francis.
Joe Francis. Like, okay, this guy totally based on him, who gets what he deserves. And it's amazing, and everyone just went for it. No one, and you didn't know because they killed off like people. That, I didn't think they were going to kill.
Yeah,
character.
No, babe. Characters played by famous people.
Yeah.
So you know, so yeah, Piranha 3D. I think really surprised a lot of people, and it got much better reviews, I'm sure, than they expected. Because originally they told us that there was an embargo.
But it's interesting,
and we were like, "But wait, we love it." Oh, and then they were like, "Okay, then go ahead."
Here's what's weird: like this movie opened, and isn't it on VOD at the same time?
I don't know about that.
I'm pretty sure it is.
They opened
up.
It on 75 screens.
Oh,
they,
wait a second.
They are dumping this thing.
Okay, but wait a second. So, but my understanding is, and this is the way that movies are being marketed. This is a whole other segue into a discussion that fit like Morgan Spurlock's Comic-Con movie, among other movies,
uh-huh.
are not coming out. It's day and date. This is the future of the releasing films now is you will pay scaled to how you choose to see it, whether it's the theatrical experience, whether it's a VOD experience.
Well,
it's
a lot of the VOD stuff comes out before the theatrical. Like,
right,
all,
like Tim
all
and Eric's billion-dollar movie.
All the Magnolia movies. I mean, Dave and I almost never go to screenings of those because it's easier for us to pay the $10 and watch it on Amazon and watch it on our TiVo.
You save the gas and the parking and the refreshments.
Well, and you get to pick when you're going to do it. You don't have to like fit your schedule or if there's, you know, competing screenings on the same night.
Or drive to. So this is what it always kills me with going to screenings and whatnot is you got to drive all of the... And it's just to see this thing, it's like, you know what, give me a download code or something at
yeah.
this point.
So, you know, like, you know, we just watched, which we'll be talking about next week, Bellamy, that new Robert Pattinson movie. Because it was available, but yeah, a lot of those titles you can just get from iTunes or Amazon before they even hit theaters. I don't know the Piranha 3DD.
I believe it's available on VOD, but you should talk about it while I look it up on my device.
Anyway, it is. It tries like obviously the first movie sort of raised the bar like that you really got to deliver, you've really got to be crazy and funny and interesting and smart. And so, you know, it's directed by John Gulliger, who, you know, like I remember the last season of Project Greenlight where they did the horror movie.
I like him, and I'm sure his dad's in the movie.
His dad is in the movie. The first movie, you know, Richard Dreyfuss gets eaten before the
right.
credits.
Oh my
and,
god!
In this movie, it's Gary Busey and Clu Gulliger.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, and it involves cow fart. And I thought, okay, this could maybe work. We're onto something here. This is kind of funny. And then it's just like, it's so tired. It's a typical kind of, you know, these sort of horror movie trope characters you've seen a million times, the good girl and the bad girl and the blah, blah, blah. And it just feels so forced, you know?
So,
like,
because the first one was definitely not. So this in this case, you're saying it just totally feels like it's forced and doesn't.
Yeah, they're trying. It's like, look at how outrageous we're being, you know? Like there's a female character who somehow has a piranha enter her when she is skinny dipping, and she doesn't figure out what it is for a while until
we've all met chicks like that.
Until she has sex for the first time, and you know it gets bitten, and it's like. Really? I mean, it's just, you know, that it's in the first movie, the whole let's bite off his wang is actually done in a funny kind of way. And it's, you're right, the character has it coming. And this time it's just like, vagina dentata. Why not? You know, we're just going to throw that in there and, you know.
Vagina dentata.
Yes.
You know, Google that.
Not to be confused with Hakuna Matata. you know, and then like a couple of characters from the first film who I'm pretty sure died come back, you know, randomly.
They don't care.
No, not at all. And which would be forgivable if they did anything interesting or funny with them, but they don't. One of them has prosthetic legs because they got bitten off in the first movie, and then later they become like guns, like in Planet Terror, but again, not in a funny way. And then it's almost like, you can tell in the last 10 minutes, suddenly they're like, oh, we need to up the ante here. So there's like several decapitations in the last 5 or 10 minutes of the movie where it's sort of like, oh, we need to cram this in here really quickly because we've been killing too much time doing other stuff. It just doesn't have that spark that Piranha 3D had.
I think Piranha 3D knew what it was and didn't, like, again, I don't think it tried too hard. It's just enough over the top. And I will say, for those of you in the podcast listening audience who think that the internet is completely worthless, I will prove you wrong because I have done a search on the internet and confirmed the fact. Yes, you can find facts on the internet. It's not all, you know, BS.
And cats.
Yes, Day and Date. Look at the top one from the Hollywood Reporter. There's another one there.
Oh, okay.
Stars. Right.
Oh, and it's a three. And they're doing it 3D Day and Date for people who have 3D television.
Right. 3D Day and Date. So there are a whole slew of stories. And
okay.
There are more films doing this, and I do think, unfortunately, it's going to be associated with things that are bad. Remember that direct to DVD. They then tried to change it to DVD premiere. Wow. You remember that term. And it's like, it's because now it's going to be, unfortunately, VOD is going to be associated with, oh, this must be awful because it's also VOD. They're dumping it because they don't have the marketing dollars.
I would hope not. I mean, I saw Melancholia, you know, as a video on demand because Magnolia, you know, that's...
Oh, I love Magnolia the way they do
that's
it.
That's Mark Cuban's company, and he's very into that whole thing. And so I like to think they're kind of taking the stench off of it.
I'm curious about the numbers on VOD. Like, is it like Day and Date? Like you know, I almost feel like there's a sense of shame. Like, well, it's VOD and... But I bet if you look at the numbers, it has to be significant. Otherwise, why would they be doing it?
Sure. And I mean, think about it. For people that don't live in New York or Los Angeles, for them, a lot of times, they now get to see these smaller indie movies when everybody else does. Like Margin Call, I remember, was a biggie. And I think, they said it was the first Oscar-nominated movie that opened this way. But I think it did a lot of its business VOD because they couldn't afford a big theatrical release. I don't know that it got outside of a lot of the major markets, but because of the cast and, you know, the reviews that it was getting, if people are going to are staying home from movie theaters in general and waiting for Netflix, unless it's some big eventy thing like the Avengers or whatever, why not speed up the process, you know,
right,
for your four person, you know, intimate drama that's all set in somebody's house in the Hamptons or whatever.
Right. But normally they don't even do this, but they even announced within the first like week of the Avengers coming out, the day it would come out on Blu-ray.
Oh, right.
Including
a
mock-up of the Avengers box, which also you can get this sort of Marvel 10 disc, 6 movie.
Right. All the movies that led up to it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's such a big part of the financial equation of profits for a film. These movies that cost in the hundreds of millions of dollars. We're not talking about Piranha, you know, 3DD, but these other films that like, they've got to recoup that money quickly.
Yeah.
They really have to turn it around fast because, I mean, there's so many things at stake with this, and just like, you know, with budgets just ballooning out of control, that they have to find these new ways to make money because theatrical is really it's marketing just for when they make money in the other ways.
Right.
It's because with the marketing costs are so prohibitively high in addition to just making the film itself, it's insane. What must be compromised and what must be done to just get to profits quickly.
But this is an ever-changing process. I mean, like we were talking before about those roadshow movies in the 60s, and that would be literally where a movie would go from city to city and play these engagements where people would buy their reserved seat tickets months in advance, like it was a play.
Yeah.
And then later it would sort of, after doing that tour of the roadshow, it would make its way to what they called the suburban theaters, you know, and play in regular release. And then, you know, in the 70s, I mean, we just talked a couple of weeks ago, they celebrated the 35th anniversary of Star Wars opening. Mm-hmm. And that movie opened on what, 8 screens?
8 screens. Oh, I remember. And one was in Detroit. It was at the Americana Theater in just outside of Detroit. And I saw it there. I think it was like a day after it opened, because it opened on a Wednesday, which was weird.
Right.
It was like May 25th on a Wednesday. I saw it like, I think that Friday. And the only reason I saw it is because I didn't know what it was, except everything I saw in the commercial, it's got spaceships and aliens. I just want to see that.
I didn't see it for probably another couple weeks, month, because I remember it opened in one theater in Atlanta, and it opened like downtown or on the other side of town from where I lived. And I was in the burbs, you know, and I didn't really know what it was. And I certainly, you know, I was 10, so I wasn't like driving or anything.
And you didn't want to go downtown because you're white.
It wasn't like that. It just wasn't, you know, like we had, there were movie theaters near us. Why would we go to that one?
We have a caller online. We gotta wait for that. I hope they ask a movie question, because that would be awesome.
No, it'll stop. Anyway, so the release of movies it's ever changing, and I think, you know, I remember in I guess about 10 years ago, I remember like at Sundance, Allison Anders had that movie Things Behind the Sun, which my old college friend Kim Dickens was in, and she talked about after Sundance, because she made a deal at Sundance for it to premiere on Showtime, which at the time was sort of like, what, you're not gonna go theatrical, you're gonna debut on television, you know. And she explained that the best offer that she was gonna get was gonna put her on about like 3 theaters,
right,
you know, on opening weekend, as opposed to like having millions of people see it at the same time, you know, when it aired on Showtime.
Well, it's interesting because the movie Sex, Lies, and Videotape,
right,
before it premiered at Sundance, which was, I think that was the first year, it was 1989, when they changed the name from the United States Film Festival to the Sundance Film Festival. And that movie it was actually intended to be a direct-to-VHS movie.
Ha!
It was supposed to be an exploitation film that Steven Soderbergh had made.
Funny.
And he diverted from that, and while it did have nudity and sex and a provocative title and whatnot, because he sold it based on the title.
Sure.
He delivered something that was much deeper. I mean, it definitely, you know, was an indie film drama and introduced, you know, James Spader to the American public, among other, right? Is that
well, the, no, he'd already
well,
done,
that's
like,
right, he'd already done.
It introduced him as an adult. You know, he'd done like Pretty in Pink and,
oh, that's right,
Tough
that's,
Turf.
And oh, that's right, he'd been the jerky teen.
Yes.
Yeah, but yeah, definitely is a more serious actor.
Right.
But what's interesting about that is it was made on the basis of a video. You're making a direct-to-VHS movie. But no one owned the theatrical.
Oh.
So when he showed it at Sundance, he could only sell the theatrical. That's the asset he had. And then it went on to win, I believe, the Palme d'Or
at Cannes
that year. And then that really created, that to me is the year of indie. Indie began.
That was the year that, Sundance really became a thing. And I mean, because obviously indie cinema goes all the way back to, you know, United Artists.
They didn't call it indie cinema. Terms.
Underground was its own
underground
thing.
Underground,
like,
was, they called them regional movies. That was what they called them back
then. But you have people like Cassavetes, you know, and Joan Micklin-Silver, who were making movies outside of the studio system, but who also weren't making like exploitation films or, you know.
Right. Or Roger Corman.
Or Kushar brother kind of movies. Like they were in the... But yeah, I don't know what the term
is. Is it
Kushar
or Kuchar? I always said Kuchar.
I'm not really sure.
I'm not sure either.
Right.
Well.
Interesting story about Sundance having to change its name.
Yes.
They were sued by the USA Film Festival in Dallas.
Oh my God, I never knew that.
Because USA had been around since 71, and then they were being the United States, and a lot of times the US Film Festival.
Right.
And so USA was like, no. No. And so they changed it to Sundance.
Wow. Wow. But I really mark that as the year, and it's
that was just the year indie broke.
The year indie broke mainstream, let's say that. It existed before, but that term was never used. I started Film Thread in 1985.
Wow.
I was just out of high school, and I created it in high school and just never got around to putting an issue out until I left. But it was just strange because we covered cult and underground movies and, you know, obscure cinema was, and it was really the term indie. That's when that became the thing. That's kind of when Film Threat kind of followed that trend.
Sure.
And so we were going to be the indie film mag.
Interesting.
So yeah, all that ties in from the beginning.
Your timing was perfect.
Tying it in, yeah.
Look at you.
So what? So you were disappointed in it, and I could see that.
I thought for me it was a big letdown, and believe me, as somebody who was a huge Piranha 3D fan, I thought it was a blast, and I was excited that there was going to be another one, and then it just.
Why can't now? I bet you would come back for Piranha 3 Triple 4D or whatever if it was on one of those gay male cruises. You see these billboards up on, you know, on Santa Monica, and I always see this. I'm like, that seems like it would be such a blast.
You promise me they all get eaten.
Right, exactly. But that would be the twist, right?
No survivors. Then I'm. So let's talk about DVD recommendations. I was going to talk about the Blu-ray of Yellow Submarine comes out this week, which is an awesome movie, and it would be great to see it without a bunch of hippies, which is when Dave and I saw it at the New Art when they reissued it once. It was the entire crowd was really irritating that way. But I want to give a shout out to friend of the program, Malcolm Ingram, who hosts the Blowhard podcast every week. His latest documentary, Bear Nation, just came out on Kino Video, and it is a documentary about the bear subculture of the gay subculture, about dudes.
What would you know about that?
I know. It was a whole new world to me. It's, you know, dudes with a little extra poundage and some hair on their face and elsewhere, and you know, how they exist in the world and in the world of gays. Kevin Smith, who is the executive producer, is interviewed in it and talks about sort of discovering that he was a bear icon. And
now he's kind of Kevin Smith is America's first straight bear.
Pretty much, yeah.
He's a straight bear.
He talks about, like, you know, going to the, you know, I think Malcolm took him to International Bear Rendezvous in San Francisco, and he said it was the first, he walked into a room and it was the first time he ever had felt, like, sexualized in front of all these people. You know? Like, he was the Marilyn Monroe of the room. It was amazing.
Wow.
And then he interviews Bob Mould and lots of other people. It's a fun movie. It's worth checking out.
Well, on that note, if I could throw in a DVD recommendation, Malcolm's first documentary, also executive produced by Kevin Smith, Small Town Gay Bar.
Yes, very fine film.
Such a great film, and I'm sure it's on Netflix and your sources for DVD and or VOD, but just look up Small Town Gay Bar, a brilliant documentary about gay bars that are in places in the country, you know, where it might be dangerous to actually just go there. And what's fascinating is seeing the history of these places. And, you know, you hear they tell all these stories of abuse. Of just going to that bar makes you marked potentially for death.
Yeah, well, and how back in the day, like, you know, the local preachers would write down all the license plate numbers in the parking lot and then read them out on the radio.
Yeah, no, it was horrifying. I mean, just like, I just, you know, we live in LA, which is a, you know, fairly evolved city.
Sure.
We have our share of jerks. but you know, I guess we don't really think about here. And like, and when I was watching, I mean, it was just like horrified. And then not only that, on a weird note, it's so beautifully photographed. They do these interviews and these sort of portrait, it's almost like portraiture of each of the people that they follow and focus on. And it's just beautifully photographed. And it really was a passion project for Malcolm, which was funny because I knew him when he didn't know he was gay. And I met him at the Toronto Film Festival in the 80s when I was banned from the Toronto Film Festival. He was a volunteer. Do you know the story?
When I first started reading Film Threat, it was always the annual article of how you snuck into parties at the Toronto Film Festival, which became this sort of fascinating thing. Like I would look forward to that issue every year. Like, oh, what mustache did he wear this time?
Right. You know. But I we were banned from it because we wrote an article that was now the kind of stuff that Entertainment Weekly does every issue. It's not particularly pioneering, but back then and when I look at it now and I really look at old issues of Film Threat, I think this was just the internet attitude before the internet existed.
Right, it was on paper.
It was that punk rock kind of attitude. And I look at it, there's nothing shocking in it now because this is how we communicate online and this is the sort of general attitude online, which was an attitude that existed in a lot of arenas. Now it's just sort of bubbled more mainstream. But like that got us banned. And Malcolm, I met at the festival. And
you were Snark when Snark wasn't cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but he knew that we were coming. Couldn't help us out. We got in, became friends with him. Slept on the floor of his apartment.
Oh my!
And then when he moved to LA, you know, gave him. I said, hey, you want to write for us? Write for us, whatever. And he worked with the editor at the time, Paul Zimmerman. I was running a bunch of magazines, but Malcolm, it was just weird because he was one of those guys where we would fear for our lives going out with him. And here's why: so much pent up anger. And he was the guy that threw around anti-gay terms way more loosely than any of us were like comfortable with saying, like, are you okay, dude? Like, you're kind of using that F word a little too much. Like, we're not like comfortable. It was really weird how much anger he had and how we were afraid that he would always just want to, he would want to get in a fight no matter where we went. It was like, dude, you got to chill out. Hadn't seen him for a couple of years, and he'd become effectively then sort of Kevin Smith, because he befriended Kevin Smith when he did a story for Film Threat.
I was saying, you guys sent him to the Mallrats set, right? Sent him to the, and he like stayed for the entire shoot.
Stayed for the whole shoot, became friends with Kevin Smith, and then suddenly he's, you know, he's sort of a sort of bodyguard slash friend and whatnot. So I see Malcolm years later, and I think, oh, I didn't even know Malcolm directed at Small Town Gay Bar. And I happen to love, I think it was John Waters that really got me into gay cinema. It was just like, I like anything, and it was sort of like, it's that whole thing of like, you know, foreign films. It just, it's different. It's a different perspective. Sure. I like to see different perspectives. I like mainstream movies as much as I like anti-mainstream movies. The good ones, right?
Right.
I think we both do.
Yeah. You just, but, and yeah, it's nice to sort of like see things from a different perspective and just from a different worldview going into whatever situation or characters are being.
Worldview, yeah. Gender view, ethnic view, racial, it doesn't matter. Sure. It's just all it's the gamut. And Sundance represents that better, I think, than anywhere.
Yeah.
And Small Town Gay Bar was on my schedule to see just the name. Mm-hmm. I was, went in and it's like, oh, wait a sec, Malcolm Ingram. I know Malcolm Ingram. I see him up there. I go up and I give Malcolm this big hug. And he's like, the weight of the world had melted off of him. All that anger gone. He could be who he was. He's like, what can I say, man? I like dick. I'll have to bleep that.
Yes.
But yeah, but he just was like, he introduced me to his boyfriend at the time.
Right.
His parents were flying in, who he hadn't told yet.
I remember that.
Kevin Smith gave, because I was at the world premiere, gave this amazing speech. You were at that screening.
Yes.
He gave the speech that was like stand-up comedy for 10 minutes. He went on about how he knew Malcolm and how, and it was just, he was so funny. I that's got to be preserved somewhere. Someone recorded that. And the movie turned out to be awesome as well. So it was just like a real magical thing of seeing like his coming out was making that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, I just have an affection for that film that goes beyond the movie just because of that personal
connection. History with him. Yeah.
Yeah. So no. You should not, you can't take my review with any sort of credibility because of that personal connection. I'm disclosing that now after the fact, but still I think it holds up.
No, absolutely. And you know, I think it's amazing. It's a movie that's really smart about, there's this notion that if you're a gay person, you just have to up and go to San Francisco. You know, like you don't get to stay in the country if you're from the country. And this is a movie about people who are like, nope, this is where I live. This is where I'm from. And no one's going to make me leave. So I'm going to make this part of the world work for me. And I'm going to go to this bar and I'm going to go find other people who are like me who are also living here. We don't all flee to, you know, the nearest metropolitan center. You know?
And it's interesting, too, because Malcolm pointed out to me that the reason he wanted to make Small Town Gay Bar is like he was gay, but a different kind of gay. He wasn't like the kind that like, oh, let's go to this bar and we'll have the Cosmatinis and the this and the blah, blah, blah. It's like he didn't like that. It's like I like dive bars. I like just kicking it. I don't care. I'm a bigger dude. Like, and there's a place that I never knew about that, you know? But I love that he's just like, look, he's not effeminate at all. I
mean, and that's
like
and that's what Bear Nation is about too. Right. It's like dudes who are gay who don't feel like any of the gay stuff they ever saw growing up, you know?
Right.
Like
Paul Lind. They're not like
exactly.
Paul
Lind. Like I you know, like a good friend of ours who you know, when we met him, who's actually married to a woman, and who is now out and, you know, they've divorced and he has a boyfriend and everything. But like at the time, there was like the only gay person he knew was this guy in his office who basically would like lip sync to Britney Spears all the time. And then it wasn't until he met Dave White that he realized, oh, you mean I can be gay and like these super loud, you know, noise bands and, you know, crazy art stuff and not dress like that. And, you know, so yeah, I think that's what's, you know, if there's any sort of unifying thing for both of his movies, it's the idea of there's a gajillion ways to be gay. There's not just this one sort of advertiser-supported version that we get spoon-fed all the time that is the way you have to do it. You
know? Absolutely. Or the cliches that people say about gay is this.
Right, exactly.
And also, a little caveat, like, I am not gay And I love gay, not all gay cinema. Some of it is just really pretentious. Yeah, no, but you know what I'm talking about. There's like so many of those pretentious, like, okay, I get it. But like, I like that kind of cinema because offering an alternative view. And it's not just about being gay, small town gay bar and or Bear Nation. It's also about being able to be free to be who you are,
sure,
whatever that is. And that's why I think it's transcendent in that way. It's not just about like gay culture. It's about I found my tribe in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's about being an individual even within a larger, you know, like that. Not only do you not fit in with the world at large, you don't even fit in with this subculture that you're supposed to be a part of.
Yeah, it's like,
and you have to carve out your little corner of it.
Right. Basically. The way I could connect to that is it's kind of like how Doctor Who fans used to be treated at Comic-Con like 10 years ago when there wasn't this resurgence of Doctor Who. You would see the Doctor Who fans walking around with the scarves and all that. You kind of go like, yeah, those guys are really into Doctor Who. And, you know, I grew up with Doctor Who, but like that.
Russell Davies made it cool.
Yeah, well, now it's like cool. Now it's cool. Now it's cool to like Doctor Who, but it's sort of like the subsets of any, like, I mean, geek culture is one subset, but there are subsets within that. And with gay culture, there is that too. And even among, you know, in the black community, we're talking about, there's like, you know, light skin. I didn't know about light skin blacks until Spike Lee made, what was his second film?
School Days. Yeah,
Yeah, like I didn't know that was a thing, but it's just interesting how much we tribe up.
Sure, yeah. You know? It's like, well, I'm a Star Trek fan. Star Trek Voyager.
Right. Ew, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're into Deep Space Nine. Wow.
This has been a hoot. And I what I love about this is you are now going to carve this thing up and repurpose it for your own show, which is brilliant.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, it's my show for your listening audience who's never heard of it. It's called Pod Crash with That Chris Gore.
Mm.
It's on iTunes, it's Stitcher, you know, various places. And the premise is that I'm too lazy to do a podcast. So I just go on other people's podcasts like Alonzo and Dave White. And then it's two things. One, it means I'm the guest on every show.
Right.
But the fun thing is that they get to, you know, my audience, or if you listen to my podcast, you get tastes of other types of podcasts.
The sampling platter.
It's sort of like, yeah, if you can't decide what to get, you just get the, I want everything. I want the nachos, the fries, and the potato skins and all that. It's kind of like, so that way you get a taste of these other shows. It's not just movie-related shows. I did a show called Wheel Nerds about biker geeks.
Nice.
So every show is different. I've done shows about music, sex, comedy, film. It's like geeky, sexy, funny, weird kind of runs. I'm even doing an ice fishing podcast.
Ooh,
coming up.
I just found out that my sister listens to a knitting podcast. So you got to get hooked up with that.
Okay. Well, I would like to do a crafting podcast because I'm really into crafting.
Are you?
Yeah, oh, Dad. No, definitely. I'm actually doing a show for the internet for a company called Machinima called Craft Holes. And it's a show about crafting for guys.
Nice. I could hook you up with some dudes who know their way around a decoupage.
Oh, it's okay. Look, yeah. Well, mine involves fire and paint and metal and like all kinds of weird
crafting.
Well, yeah, but just things to, I don't know. You'll see the show when it comes out on Machinima Network.
All right.
But enough of the plugs. Enough about me. You can follow me on Twitter at @ChrisGore, more at ChrisGore.com. Enough about me. It was great. Alonzo, I have to thank you just for inviting me. You invited me out of the blue over Facebook because we're Facebook friends.
Yes.
I appreciate coming on here and being able to talk to you. I love reading your reviews and your opinion on stuff.
Oh,
and the fact that, you know, this podcast, when I heard it existed, I thought, it's just a matter of time, you'll get me on here. I'm really happy. I really can't wait to hear what my audience thinks of Linoleum Knife.
Well, thank you, Chris Gore. I appreciate it. And our quick plugs, you can like us on Facebook at the Linoleum Knife podcast page. You follow us at Twitter at @LinoleumCast. Check into the show on getglue.com, even though we're listed as a TV show. What are you going to do? My list of other podcasts that I plug has disappeared, and I blame Dave White even though he probably had nothing to do with it. So I'll try and do it from memory. Check out our friends at the Popcorn Mafia, the Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Blowhard, which we previously mentioned, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, Secretly Timid, Film Spotting SVU, the B Movies Podcast, Pod Crash with That Chris Gore, of course.
Film Threat's a podcast. Film Threat hasn't had a podcast for years.
I got to check that one out then.
And it's run by Mark Bell, who's also he's a straight bear.
Oh, well, okay. That's you know, it's funny. I remember talking to John Waters about bears. He goes, all straight men over the age of 40 are bears. So they might as well embrace it. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, and if you haven't already, leave us a review and tell folks you like the show. It helps other people find us. Oh, the Game Night guys. And anyway, thank you for listening. This has been a treat. And next week, I'm here. Dave White is here. We are back to normal, and things will happen. So tune in then. Thanks for listening. Bye.